thanks for coming along, and it's good to see so many of you here for, as I agree with Shona, a very, very significant event. As was mentioned before, the event's been organised in association with Document 3, which is a documentary film festival, which will be taking place from the 21st to the 24th of October here in Glasgow. You'll find these programmes probably just about everywhere. So all the information you need about that festival is actually in this brochure. Shona's already spoken a bit about Robert. There's not much more I need to say beyond the fact that Lee French from Variant Magazine received a personal email from Noam Chomsky telling us that we have to look after him because he's a treasure. John Pilger has also called him probably the greatest war correspondent alive today. And also, for some reason, which he may go into, John Malkovich wants to kill him. So we maybe find out a bit more about that later. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Robert Fisk.
Is the sound okay? Is the sound okay? Yeah, fine. Ladies and gentlemen, I enjoyed the bit about the mobile phones, because when I was giving a lecture in Dublin, and this is not a lecture, this is just a talk ad hoc to you, but I was giving a lecture in Dublin a few months ago, and I said that anyone whose mobile phone rang while I was speaking would be sold into slavery. And immediately, a mobile phone rang, and it was mine. So let your mobile phones ring. It's a newsroom as far as I'm concerned. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not trying to give you a hard sell on my book, but I've spent the last 20 months writing it and putting it together, and it's rather changed my views of the Middle East. It's probably changed my views of myself. And I wanted to talk to you about what it was like to write and why I was writing it. Oddly enough, it started off 20 years ago with a contract to write a book on modern Egyptian history, which mercifully I didn't have to write. It was going to be a tourist book for British tourists who wanted to know about the Suez Crisis and Nasser rather than pharaohs and pyramids. Nice idea. But as the years went by and I kept postponing writing the book, I decided that what I wanted to do was an epic tragedy of the Middle East, which I've been watching, and which I've been watching for over 29 years now, living in the Muslim Middle East, in Beirut primarily, but going to virtually every country in the region, and unfortunately for me, covering every war. The book is really meant, and I realized as I was writing it, because I learned about it as I wrote it, to say that we must refuse to accept the narrative of history that is laid down by our betters, by our prime ministers and by our presidents and by our generals. That we must somehow say, why did history crucify the Middle East? Why does it still touch us? Can we escape from history? Are we able to say, enough, stop, forget the Balfour Declaration, forget the Oslo Agreement, forget Sykes-Picot, we'll start again. Part of this book, the spine of the book, if you like, is about my father. My dad, Bill Fisk, was much older than my mother, and he was a soldier in the First World War, 1914-1918. He arrived at Arras on the Somme in 1918 in August. Amazingly, for a man who always obeyed the rules, he took a camera to the trenches of France. And so I have photographs of him in uniform with his steel helmet on in the trenches. He even put his hands up and twice took a picture of No Man's Land and brought it down again. And it looks just like it does in all the paintings and pictures, broken trees, mud, dirt, barbed wire. But one thing he did in that war, which was quite remarkable for him, he was ordered at the end to execute an Australian soldier to command the firing party of an Australian soldier who had killed a British military policeman in Paris. The soldier was 19, and my father was 19. And my dad, whom I didn't get on very well with, was a very right-wing man. He believed, the father that I remember after 1946, when I was born, he believed in capital punishments, policemen, discipline, magistrates, courts, long prison sentences. Very right-wing guy. You can imagine what wonderful conversations we used to have. And sadly, and maybe this book is partly an apology to him, when he was dying, I didn't go and see him. But in the First World War, faced with an order to to carry out the execution by firing party, he refused. I think he was the only officer who did refuse to carry out an execution. The Australian soldier had a very tragic history. He had been in the Australian army, he'd fought in Gallipoli, he'd been invalided out, missed being a soldier, went to London and joined the Royal Artillery, which was his biggest mistake. The Australians never executed their soldiers, the British did. In fact, he was drunk in Paris, he went AWOL, the Australian this is, and he was asked for his papers by a British military policeman in a hotel in Paris, you know, papier, monsieur. And it's still a hotel, oddly enough. I've been and stayed in the Australian's room where he spent his last night before being taken away. And I've stood on the landing where he murdered or killed, I think it was probably an accident, the British military policeman. At the public record office in London, I went to look up his file. I had his last appeal for clemency, in which he said he would live a straightforward life if his life would be spared. It was not, of course. He was executed in March of 1919 at 4:14 in the morning at Le Havre. I also found there the execution envelope listing the names of the firing squad and the officer commanding them. And the black dog of journalists in me made me think I'd better check the name of the officer just in case my father had romanticized his role and had not refused. And it was an infinite relief to find that the initials were CSW, different regiment, different officer, different name, different rank. It was not my father. He did refuse. His punishment at that stage, at the end of the war, was to go around the Western Front digging up the corpses and putting them in the great British war cemeteries, which some of you may have seen on the Somme and around Ypres today. In any event, I always associated my father with the First World War. My mother, who was much younger, she was a radio repair officer in the Royal Air Force, repairing radios on damaged Spitfires during the Battle of Britain in 1940. So I actually grew up with two people of different ages for whom wars were the most dramatic and tragic moments in their lives. And I listened to it, heard about it over and over and over again. When I was 10 years old, my father took me to France to show me the very trenches where he fought and the village Louvencourt, where he spent the first night of the 11th of November 1918, the first night of peace after the ceasefire, which led, of course, to the Versailles Treaty. But as I researched the book, one of the things that became painfully obvious to me was the degree to which the life I have lived for the past 29 years hinged on the war my father fought in. Because in 17 months after that war, just 17 months, we, the victors, primarily, of course, the British and the French, drew the borders of Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, and most of the Middle East. And I have spent my entire professional career in Belfast, Belgrade, Bosnia, Beirut, Baghdad, watching all the peoples in those borders burn. That's why I asked the question, can we stop history somewhere? Is it possible? It was a very distressing book to write. At the beginning, I should add that I keep all my notes, everything, 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 every note, every newspaper I pick up, every propaganda leaflet. Mercifully, I had a young French researcher who went through 328,000 papers in my archives, my library at home. Excuse me. In any event, at the beginning of the book, I was writing in a very light-hearted way because I remembered when I first went to the Middle East. I was actually covering the aftermath of the Portuguese Revolution, sitting on a beach at a place called Porto Covo, south of Lisbon, when the postmistress called me and said I had a letter from London. Louis Heron, my foreign editor, and actually a former Middle East correspondent, he was at Deir Yassin, where the massacre was in 1948, had sent me this letter saying that Paul Martin, The Times, of course I was working for the London Times then before it began to go downhill later on, in a big way, that Paul Martin, our correspondent in Beirut, had just got married to a billionaire German princess who objected to starting her married life in the Beirut Civil War, Lebanese Civil War. So would I like the job of Middle East correspondent? He said it would be a life of great adventure and lots of sunshine. Of course, I said yes, didn't I? And so I set off to what I thought would be a life of great adventure. I was going to be able to witness history. I thought it would be a 3-year assignment, not a 29, 30, 33-year assignment, but there you go. In any event, when I began writing my book, I decided I wouldn't make it chronological. So it begins with my meetings with Osama bin Laden, both in Sudan and in Afghanistan. Then it goes right back to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 79-80, which I witnessed. I was in Afghanistan. I was actually arrested by the Soviet army. And then it goes to the Iran-Iraq war, probably the war that affected me most if I look back on it, because it was 1.5 million dead, was not unlike the Somme, my father's war. And then it moves from there back to my father. There's a whole chapter on my father in the First War and his refusal to execute this young man. And then right back to the Armenian genocide 3 years before that. And then it moves to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Algerian War, both the War of Independence against the French and the appalling throat-cutting war which I covered in the 90s. And then to the 1990 invasion of Kuwait. And then we pick into the chronology, so that the book goes faster and faster and faster and faster, right up to the anarchy, chaos, and tragedy of Iraq as it is today, with Western troops in the wilderness of occupation, and the Iraqis paying the price, and we not caring a damn what their price is, because we only care about our own soldiers. So I got to page 200, I think it was, or 210, and I'd gone into the Iran-Iraq war, and at the very beginning, the Iraqis allowed us to go right up to the front line. We could travel with their commandos, we could invade Iran with them, which we did. I actually crossed the border with the first Iraqi troops, and under Shelfar went all the way to Horamshah. In those first days, I was great friends with John Snow, whom you'll know as the anchorman, as well as newspaper, television correspondent now. And John, for various reasons that I won't bore you with now, found himself tasked with rescuing the crew of a British ship that was trapped in the Shatt al-Arab waterway between Iran and Iraq. Rockets and shells were going past it in both directions. So John said, listen, Fiske, we haven't got any maps. If you can get an Admiralty map of the Shatt al-Arab, I'll take you along. So, of course, Bob goes through all these ships that are marooned inside Basra and finds a Baltic sea captain who has a beautiful Royal Navy map of the Shatt al-Arab. The Iraqi army, needless to say, didn't have a map of their own river. So I took it along to John, off we went. He went across in a rubber boat at night under fire, and we got all the crew off. One of the most memorable sequences was John pulling ashore young English women and their husbands, while I took from most of the crew, who of course were not British at all, but Filipino, all their duty-free fridges and chucked them back in the river because we didn't have any room for the fridges when we went back across this mud-soaked island. The weeping of the Filipinos as I threw color televisions into the Shatt al-Arab was meant to be seen. Anyway, we got the film out, and I got a, because John crossed the river and I did not, I got a telex next morning. We didn't, of course, have emails or mobile phones then. A telex from London, from my foreign desk, with the immortal words, Fisk, why you not crossed shark-infested Shatt al-Arab River? As I finished that particular tale, I went and read it to a very dear friend of mine who was in my home, and I said, you know, this is the last story which I wrote, which was happy. And she said, ah, that is the end of the sweet stories. And I wrote, the next paragraph of the book begins, so that is the end of the sweet stories. Because the rest of the book is unmitigatedly torture, pain, injustice, genocide, and war. And I can tell you that most people in the West who don't go to Iraq or aren't soldiers, there is still this idea, I find, when I talk to people, that war, and this is founded, I think, on Hollywood, that war is primarily about victory or defeat. It is not. It is primarily about death and the infliction of death, and represents the total failure of the human spirit. I have to tell that to my editors sometimes, but they haven't been in wars. Strangely enough, you're shielded from wars by us journalists. Not in the written word. I can describe every horror, but television won't do it. Oddly enough, you can see what we see in wars on feature films. If you go and watch Saving Private Ryan, you'll see the kind of gore we see. But if you watch it on television, you won't, because television has responsibility to the viewers. Television won't show you the same thing. When, after the 1991 liberation of Kuwait, at least that was a liberation, I walked and ran and drove up the highway of death, the so-called up towards Basra. An ITV crew and I found a vast number of dead Iraqi soldiers that had been blown to pieces by bombs, and hordes of dogs, desert dogs, who'd come in and were ripping the bodies to pieces and racing across the sand, arms in their mouths, dragging the fingers through the sand and eating them. Lunchtime for the dogs of the desert. The ITV crew filmed this, and I said, what are you filming it for? You'll never show it. Ah, it's just for the archives, his cameraman said. But you see, they won't show it. If you saw what I see, you would never, ever support a war again. My view is that in that sense, because of this concern about the sensitivity of viewers, television connives at war. It is the friend of the governments that go to war, because it will always soften its impact for you. Not for us, not for you if you read our writing in the paper, but don't waste your time on the television. Occasionally, they'll show a dead man, if he is obliging enough to die in a romantic pose, if he dies like this. But if it's a blasted out face with no eyes and burned, you will not see it on television. We see it. I wish you could see it sometimes. I'm sorry to say that. In any event, from that stage on in my book, someone described it the other day as a walk through a constant graveyard. It is not a happy book. My researcher realized I was becoming very depressed writing it. She came down to my library one afternoon at 4 o'clock and said, Robert, you're going for a walk with me. We're going to walk by the sea. We're going to have a pint of Guinness. And every afternoon at 4 o'clock, I escaped from the Middle East, excuse me, and went and had my pint of Guinness. And believe me, I needed it. When I finished the book, actually in Beirut I finished it, I couldn't believe it was over. I'd finished absolutely on the point where I was about to return to Iraq, and did return to Iraq, to the throat cutters and the fast-shooting Americans. And I was so inured to the idea of having free time that even when I was in Baghdad, I was thinking, what am I going to put in the next chapter? It was over. The publishers already had it in London. But that that was the experience of writing the book. I began to realize that when I covered a war, I would go to the Iran-Iraq war in the frontline trenches, and then after a month I'd go back to Beirut, where there was also a war, of course, but nonetheless it was more livable in. I'd go out to dinner, I'd go on holiday for a month, it would be Christmas, and then I'd go back to the Iran-Iraq war on both sides. So for me, it was always broken up. There was relief. But in the book, of course, you chop out the holidays. Well, a few of them, most of them. And when you push it all together, you realize what the people you were writing about went through. Utter, total, tragic atrocities from beginning to end. And I managed to, in some ways, link up chapters in the way that, for example, the last chapter on the Iran-Iraq war, there are three, ends with an appalling scene described to me by an Iraqi officer, because I'd been back, of course, on both sides of the war and talked to those who fought each other, where a number of young Iraqis are caught on the battlefield, not in the battle, and they're accused of desertion. And they're tied up to trees, and crying and screaming for their children and their wives, they are shot by firing squad. The next chapter is my father refusing to exercise, to execute the soldier. So I'm constantly going back to this idea of refusal, refusal, refusal. Amira Haas, who I regard as the finest journalist in the Middle East, she and I once had a long conversation in Jerusalem, more than 2 years ago now, about what our job as foreign correspondents really was. And I did the Brit thing, you know, well, our job is to write the first pages of history, the first neutral observers, so that people will never be able to say, we didn't know, no one told us. Not a bad ambition, not a bad definition. But Amira, who works for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz from Ramallah, she said, no, Robert, you're wrong. Our job is to monitor the centers of power, to challenge authority, always, without exception, especially when they take you to war, especially when they're going to kill and use lies to do it. And she's absolutely right. And now, that's what I think of my job as. Challenge, 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 all the time. Governments hate it, soldiers hate it, it doesn't matter. Because if we don't do that, we become abettors to the war. We become people who accept, indeed sell newspapers on death, which is wrong. I want to give you an illustration of the sort of way in which we began to realize, I suppose 15 years ago, that something awful was coming. The sheer amount of injustice in the Middle East, the sheer amount of death, the sheer number of dictators. We appointed and supported these dictators. We loved Saddam, remember, when he invaded Iran. Then when he invaded the wrong country, Kuwait, we bombed him. We loved Nasser at the beginning until he took the Suez Canal, and then we bombed him too. We loved Gaddafi at the beginning until he helped the IRA, and we bombed him too. The way in which people were beginning to express not just frustration, but hatred. In 1992, I tried to show this in a series of three films I made for Channel 4 in Britain and the Discovery Channel in the United States. It was called From Beirut to Bosnia. We filmed, it was $1 million. We filmed on real cinema film. We showed it in cinema. It was spectacular. I've never been in a film which has a wide screen like this. It wasn't just television. We did show it on television, of course. We filmed in West Bank, Gaza, Israel, Egypt, Lebanon, Bosnia, and Croatia. It was a devastating experience because as we made the film and cut it and cut it and cut it, the same experience in miniature of what I found in writing this book. I began to be amazed that Muslims weren't more angry with us, were so restrained. The sequence I'm going to show you is set in Bosnia, 1992. Of course, the war was still on. The Bosnian war was at its height. In which I went back to a village called Cela, where a year before I'd seen the beautiful little mosque and talked to the imam of that mosque and his family in his home. The Serbs had promised to protect them. But it's better I show you the sequence right through to the end of what happened to the mosque in Cela. And I want you to, and to the refugees from the nearest village, but I want you, if you would, to listen to the words I say when I walk into the mosque. And I will tell you now, that film was made in 1992, and we have gone back on the record, and when I walk into the mosque on this film, where it is burned out and destroyed, the day I walked in was September the 11th, 1992. Just listen to the script as I walk in. Malcolm, if we can go now, put the lights down and go with the first series on the Bosnia picture.
Cleansing. How easily we reporters accepted this phrase. The Muslims who lived in these devastated homes were raped and murdered by the Serbs, not because they were ethnically different from their Serb attackers, but because the Serbs wanted the Muslims' land, and they got it. Our reports of their plunder made no difference. A year ago, the Independent sent me into Serbian Bosnia to search for a village in which Muslims still lived. I found a village called Cela. It had a pretty mosque and a friendly imam who lived in a cottage next door. The Serbs promised to protect them. Now I was going back to see them again, accompanied by two watchful Serb policemen.
I'm sure it's the mosque. I went in there before. Keep going. This I'm sure. Yes, I remember going in here before. This is the mosque. Right. I see the problem. Can you ask the policeman what happened to this mosque? I mean, I last time I was here, I walked inside it. It was ordinary. What happened, Kathy? Okay. Can you ask him?
Onda što se dogodilo tu za džamiju za sve?
It's No picture. Okay, all right. Yeah, they'll take your film away. Okay. All right. Part of a school book.
I knew what had happened. How long would these Muslims put up with this sort of violence? How can I forget the place where I work, the Middle East? When Muslims there hit out at the West, we say we don't understand them. Mindless terrorism is the phrase we like to use about them. And every time I see things like this, I wonder what the Muslim world has in store for us. Maybe my reports should always end with the same phrase, watch out.
Well, no more mask. It had been blown up with explosives. No one would say who did it, and there wasn't any point in asking the Serb police. And here was the cottage in which the Muslim imam and his family had given me coffee just a year ago. Had disappeared, ethnically cleansed. Only a few days ago, no one would say where they were. But I recognized them from the old family snapshots. These were the people who gave me coffee a year ago. To this day, I don't know where they are. The end of the line for the Muslims of Bosnia. Despite our millions of words, despite the pictures of all our television colleagues, have we journalists made the slightest difference to this tragedy? These men and women were driven out of their homes this morning. Muslims, dispossessed, homeless, betrayed.
Why did they throw the Muslims out of Bosnia? Why have they done this to you?
Zašto mislite da Srbi su prisilili vas van?
A čuj, Bože moj, moram. Šta ja? Kako je? Kad moraš, moraš. Hajde, ostavi sve svoje I hajde. Eto kako. Ne znam, očekujemo od međunarodne zajednice da će nas preuzeti, pa kako nam Bog da I međunarodna zajednica, pa eto.
Eno se mačke.
Idemo, ne znamo gdje ni kuda.
Can I ask you, why are you leaving Bosnia?
Bogu mogu kazat, a jem mi drago, kremica su kognica nije. Kad, pa hvala Bogu, onda je djecama zovu da će prijatelj napusti, pa jedno čekam da dojde. Kad se vidim da se radi iz vatre žive, iz kutarstva, hvala Bogu, hvala Bogu.
In the Middle East, as well as Bosnia, I've spent 17 years writing about these people. It would be nice to think the world listened to us journalists occasionally, but governments have grown used to ignoring our reports. If you still believe in the New World Order, you shouldn't be watching this. Governments want us to think about peace in the Middle East. They'd rather we never saw this, never wrote about it. They'd rather we shut up.
Sadiqa, this is you?
Yeah. Sadiqa, yes.
This is you.
Yes,
and this?
Yes.
Your husband?
Yes.
He's dead. And this here is? This is your mother here who's sitting behind you now.
Yes.
What do you think when you look back at these days now?
Sami
znate, presudite sami. Ja vas molim, ne više pita.
For these Muslims, this is their moment of despair. Their day of catastrophe.
An hour ago, they were Bosnian Muslims in their own homes. Now they are refugees. Just a little local train to take them north, to a refugee camp, another country, to another world, to be scattered to the ends of the earth.
Fairly harrowing stuff, especially for filming it. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to talk to you briefly about the 11th of September. When planes crashed into the towers, I was crossing the Atlantic on a plane. I was actually using the satellite phone from business class to talk to my office in London. It was saying one plane, two planes, three planes, four planes. And I went up to the front of the aircraft and talked to the purser. The pilot had only just heard about the one. The captain of the aircraft came back. The stewardess came up and she just said, four aircraft, so many people, they all wanted to die. And the first thing I did is I looked at the purser like this and he looked at me. We didn't know where these planes had come from, but we'd just taken off and were flying across the Atlantic. And we thought to each other, who's on this plane? And he and I walked around the aircraft to see which passengers we didn't like. I found 13, all in economy. Of course, they were Muslims, weren't they? They had wari beads, they were reading Qurans, they had beards, they had darker skin, brown eyes, and they were looking at me because they thought I was suspicious. I was suspicious. And of course, when I got back to the front of the aircraft and spoke to the purser again, I realized that in just 1 minute, Osama bin Laden had turned nice, liberal Bob Fisk into a racist who was racially profiling his fellow passengers, all of whom, of course, were completely innocent. I wonder now whether that wasn't the whole purpose, to break us apart. The biggest problem about September 11th as a journalist was that no one wanted to ask the question, why? We were allowed to know who did it. 19 Arabs who called themselves Muslims. We were allowed to know how they did it. Well, obviously, box cutters, aeroplanes, tall buildings. But when we asked the question why, as I did constantly, both in the paper and on the radio and television, we were immediately maligned and condemned that we were helping terrorism. Because we all know that they flew the planes into the buildings because they hated our freedom and hated our democracy, and it was them versus us, and it was evil versus good. Which is a strange situation, because when you have a crime in the street, or a crime at a particular location, say in Glasgow, the first thing the police do is look for the motive. But when we had an international crime against humanity in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, the one thing we were not supposed to do was to look for the motive. Very easy to look for a motive, isn't it? I mean, 19 Arabs, that means they come from the Middle East. Is there a problem out there? And from all this, of course, we had Afghanistan, and then we had Iraq. I used to believe that the Iraq war was about oil. And I still think it's about oil. If Iraq's national export was asparagus or carrots, I don't think the 82nd Airborne would be in Mosul. But some weeks ago, I was investigating the murder of a poor Red Cross guy on Highway 8, a big road south of Baghdad. He'd been shot dead, and I went down. I found an Iraqi family whom I think had seen the gunman. And I was standing with them talking beside the road, and suddenly the ground began to move like this. And I looked down the road and saw this powering of exhausts into the sky. Apache helicopters began to come down like giant rodents and swoop round up over the trees. And up that road, Highway 8, came the biggest military convoy I've ever seen in my life, bigger than the Russians in Afghanistan. The Americans were switching brigades and divisions over. And down the road, for 4.5 hours it took to pass me, came Abrams M1, A1 tanks, Bradley armored fighting vehicles, truck after truck, hundreds of trucks loaded with armed troops, rifles pointing out like porcupine quills. And then 155mm artillery, light machine guns, building equipment. And I began to think that, I just watched it because I wanted to understand what this meant, something beyond just troop rotation. And I suddenly began to realize that 2,000 years ago, a little bit further west in Lebanon, I'd be sitting by the road and feeling the vibration of the tramp of Roman legions. And I began to realize that superpowers have a visceral need to project military power. They must. We can go to Baghdad, so we will go to Baghdad. We can topple Saddam, we will topple Saddam. And we shall drive our armies across Samaria and all the caliphates and all the land where civilization supposedly began, off into the wilderness of occupation. This, I suspect, is part of the folly of Iraq. You know, as a reporter, it's very hard at the moment to operate in Baghdad. I've criticized what I call hotel journalism, with, I think, good reason. Many of my colleagues now are ordered by their editors or by their many security men. Many American TV stations now have armed mercenaries, former SAS and Special Forces men, protecting them, traveling with them, guarding them, guns out the window. Great picture of journalism today. My colleague Patrick Coburn on The Independent and The Guardian and I, we move around Baghdad still, outside the hotel, with ordinary Iraqis, preferably in beaten-up cars and always desperate to read Arabic newspapers in traffic jams for obvious reasons. The New York Times, by the way, or the AP, the Associated Press News Agency, their American correspondents live behind two armored walls in the Palestine Hotel. It takes you about 5 minutes to negotiate your way in, quite a newsroom. The New York Times has a stockade of concrete and steel with four watchtowers and a battery of armed Iraqi gunmen to defend them. Each gunman wears a brown T-shirt with New York Times written on it. I kid thee not, as Captain Krieg said in Music on the Bounty. I don't blame them. They are targets. I don't blame. And the reporters, the New York Times reporters, still try to go out. They still get on the streets. But we have big problems in Baghdad. And I asked myself when I was last there, 3.5 weeks or so ago, I don't know if we can keep going like this. I don't know if I can keep going. When I was there, excuse me, there was a suicide bombing in a bus station. And I raced out, street reporter, car, go, right? Got to the bus station, jumped out of the car, two pictures, severed heads, dead baby, woman dead beside a bus. 20 seconds of conversation with a man who'd been spared being wounded but had seen everything. At which point there were 50 or 60 infuriated, enraged Iraqis around me. Get back in the car, drive away quickly, quickly, quickly. That's what I call mouse journalism. Mini, go! Well, I managed to get there. I did the story, and I had enough for 600, 700 words, and I wrote it, and The Independent published it. But I don't know if we can keep on doing that. The insurgents, of whom you should not be romantic, do not respect journalists. They do not respect any Westerners, not the United Nations, not the ICRC, not us, not me. So, and I may go back in December, but I am having serious doubts over whether I want to, over whether the story is worth the risk, or whether the risk is worth the story. The strange thing about covering Iraq is that you realize from the start that the West, especially the American military, are very happy that we can't move around. When we hear that 142 terrorists have been killed by the Americans in Tel Afar, which is quite near the Syrian border, I say, I can't get to Tel Afar. It's too far. It is impossible to get there without being pulled out of the car and taken away. 142, and they were all terrorists, right? Every one of them was a terrorist, and every innocent person was spared. I don't believe it. I've never been in a war where that happens, but I can't check the story anymore. This is the problem. This is one reason why one asks oneself, is journalism working in a place like Baghdad? One of the things we can do, but we largely don't, because I believe in always having a little history book in the back pocket of journalists. I do too. I mean, I'd carry one. When I was researching for this book, I found something quite remarkable that might have just made us all hold on before we rushed into war. In 1917, the British Army, in the First World War, in its attempt to destroy the Ottomans, which it successfully did, invaded Iraq. In 1917, we reached Baghdad. And General Angus Maud, who was shortly afterwards to die because he didn't heat his milk before he drank it, issued a proclamation. A Private Charles Dickens of the Cheshire Regiment took one of his proclamations off the wall, put it in his knapsack, gave it to his daughter, who sold it to me many years later, and it stood on the wall beside me as I wrote my book. It says, "Proclamation from General Angus Maud, Commander-in-Chief, British Forces, Iraq. We come here..." It's addressed to the people of the Muhafazat, the governorate of Baghdad. "We come here not as conquerors, but as liberators, to free you from generations of tyranny." Sound familiar? In 1920, an insurgency broke out against British rule. The first British officer to die was called Leachman. He was killed at a village called Handari near Abu Ghraib, which of course you'll have heard of. I covered the death of the first American soldier by a roadside bomb. I went to the scene. It was Handari, and it was 100 meters from the spot where Leachman was killed in 1920. In revenge, the British Army took its artillery and fired into a town called Fallujah, destroying much of it, of course. We also surrounded Najaf and demanded the surrender of a Shiite clergyman called Badr rather than Sadr, who's the current clergyman we want. It's like fingerprint parallel histories. I found in London, in the Public Record Office, a British intelligence document from Baghdad to the War Office, Ministry of Defence now, of course, in London, claiming that terrorists were crossing the border into Iraq from Syria, a French mandate of Syria, it said at the time. Even more to the point, going back through copies of the Times, when it was a respectable paper, I found Lloyd George, who was then British Prime Minister, standing up in the House of Commons saying, "If British troops leave Iraq, there will be..." That's it. That's what he said, civil war. I mean, it's astonishing. There are even more parallels when we reinvaded in 1941. We're always invading the Middle East to help them and spare them and give them democracy. It's astonishing. You know, Napoleon, when he carried out the French expedition, he issued a proclamation to the people of Cairo saying, "We're coming to rescue you from the pashas who don't give you free speech." And I think, you know, I think Iraqis and other Arabs rather like some of our democracy. Nice, shiny democracy which we show them. They're like a couple of packets of human rights off the supermarket shelf as well. But the more I live there and the more I talk to them, I think they would also like freedom from us. You know, one of the most difficult things about covering Iraq is the growing realization that we don't care about Iraqis. From the start, we have listed our precious dead. All human lives are precious, and ours are. Our soldiers' lives are precious. 1,900, 1,950, I think, Americans now. 82 British, I think. But we will not calculate the life and death of the people we claim to be so keen to liberate and give democracy to. I don't think we care about the Iraqis. I don't think we care about people in the Middle East. We're quite happy to appoint their dictators or support whichever government we think is the right one that will do what we want. Look, when you go to the mortuaries, they have been given instructions by the Ministry of Health, which of course has American advisors, that they must not give out the lists of dead. I go to the mortuaries often. I've got to know the morticians and the doctors who work in these filthy, grisly places. One Monday morning, 4 weeks ago, I went to the main medical center. At 9 o'clock, there were 9 bodies on the floor. By 12 o'clock, there were 26. We're not talking about heart attack victims or people with strokes. We're talking about people who die by violence. Oddly enough, I discovered that when a body is brought in by American troops, the doctors are told you must not do an autopsy on these corpses. Now, isn't that strange? The second lot of bodies that came in on the Monday, there was a young woman with her hands tied behind her back, shot 3 times in the head, and a baby that had been shot through the forehead. There are death squads in Baghdad now, and much of Iraq, much of Baghdad, is now in the hands of insurgents. There are insurgents armed on the streets half a mile from the Green Zone, wherein the British Embassy and British diplomats and American diplomats and the new government of Iraq are attempting to still show that things are getting better. In July alone, in just Baghdad, having looked carefully at the mortician's computer, I found out that 1,100 Iraqis had been killed by violence. Put that across Iraq, add that Bakuba, Ramadi, Fallujah, Najaf, Mosul, Kirkuk, Erbil. We must be talking of at least 3,000-4,000 a month in all of Iraq. Work that out, 36,000, 48,000 a year. That 100,000 figure we were given, so derided by Blair and Bush, might be conservative. But they don't want us to know, because I don't think they care about the Iraqis. I think we should, but I don't think they should. They do, rather. They certainly should. I don't know if it's possible to escape history, but over and over and over again, I see on the ground with my own eyes as a journalist, over and over again, such humiliation, such gross injustice. I try to show it as a journalist, and so do many of my colleagues, through individual people, through individual victims who have characters, who have personalities, who are real, who are just like us. I'm going to show you a piece of film now from the same series which I made, Beirut to Bosnia, Why the Muslims Are Coming to Hate the West, in which you'll see the tragedy of a Palestinian family who have been ordered to leave their home outside Jerusalem to make way for another Jewish settlement. Malcolm, can we go ahead with the Palestinian sequence, please?
Jerusalem, holy to Jews, Muslims, and Christians, has been illegally annexed by Israel, which still claims it to be its eternal and unified capital. East of the city, outside the internationally recognized border of Israel, only a little bit of the old rural Palestine remains. And the huge Jewish settlements built on Palestinian land are now cities. A ring of Israeli concrete around Jerusalem. It takes a brave Palestinian to hold out here, to cling onto his own land in the face of Israel's expanding settlements. But in this little patch of orchard, is a family that's refused to leave its land despite an order to get out. Been told to leave their home to make way for a settlement for Jews, some of them from as far away as Russia. Your family owned this land here?
We own it as long as we live. It's inherited from our grandfathers and fathers as well.
How many years do you think that is? More than 100 years?
Yes.
Do you have the documents to prove this? Do you have the original deeds and papers proving?
Oh, of course we have. We have the documents from the Ottoman period and from the period of the British Mandate also.
And you have your tax forms, you have the documents showing that this bit of land which we're on now...
All of this, yes, we have.
Why is he fighting for his house? Ask him, would you?
Because it is his house.
Would you ask him?
ليش بقول لك يعني انت بت يعني بتحاول انك تخلي الدار ما تروحش يعني بتحارب او بت
معلوم قد ما بقدر بخليش الدار تروح ابدا مره يعني بروح ارواح انا وهذا ولا بخلي الدار تروح يا زلمه عمتي وابويا وجدي وجد جدي يخرجوا معنا
لا بناكل ولا بنشرب ولا بننام والله المرض طب فينا ومرضها هيوتنا من اللي جرانا يعني اخرى الواحد يطلع من داره ومن بيته وين نروح لنا قدره نروح نقعد في دور الناس احنا معيلين وختيار بحر علي عاجز واحنا عجز ومرضى مش ظلم هذا اللي احنا فيه
سليمان what is this document we have here
it's a warning for us to leave the house to leave our house
this is the official notice to quit
yes
now this is in Hebrew do you yes. speak Hebrew
No, not very much.
What have you done with this document? Where is the original?
We gave it to our lawyer, Jonathan Kutab.
Kutab?
Yes.
Jonathan Kutab. And he is in East Jerusalem?
Yes, in East Jerusalem.
Okay.
Although annexed by Israel, the center of East Jerusalem is still ostentatiously Arab. Israelis fear they'll be attacked here. Israeli taximen don't like to drive on this side of the city.
Center for the Study of Nonviolence. That sounds promising. Jonathan Kutab, there's our man.
He was given a charge sheet saying that he has to turn over mm-hmm. his property to the state. But you see, it was needed for a public purpose.
Public purpose meaning?
Hospitals, schools, roads, something that benefits the community. So we were told that the public purpose was a special scheme for building your own home. I said, wonderful. He's been trying very hard to build a home for his son on this land, but was told you couldn't build on it. So now if you can build on it, he would be glad to build a unit, a single apartment here, in return for turning over his property. He doesn't want money, but he wants to participate in this wonderful public scheme.
And?
Well, he was told, I'm afraid you're not a member of the public we intend to serve because the only people who are entitled under this program are either new immigrants or those who have served in the army.
But he can't serve in the army.
Well, he said our army. This has to be the Israeli army. If the purpose for which this confiscation occurred is to serve Jews and Jews only, and excludes him, we object.
Above Mohammed Khatib's home, the settlements continue to be built. And among the settlers moving in are Europeans. Sonia Layani was born in France.
Et combien d'argent vous avez payé pour cet appartement ici?
Je dois dire le prix.
Oui, oui. $190,000. Ouf. C'est extraordinaire. Mmh,
très bel appartement, six pièces, avec deux balcons et un très grand jardin.
Mais vous n'avez pas la peur d'habiter ici ?
Pas du tout.
Ce n'est pas dangereux ?
Non, pas du tout.
Mmh.
Mickey Mollard is head of the settlement's residents association.
About Arabs and Jews, mm-hmm. and here I'll let you understand a bit of the geography. Over here where the minaret is, the mm-hmm. mosque, this is a village which is outside of Jerusalem.
And it's obviously an Arab.
It is an Arab
Muslim.
Village, Muslim. It's called Chizmeh. In front of us, you see your build your own house scheme, mm-hmm. where we see on the right hand of it, we see an Arab house, mm-hmm. and he was owner of part of the land, and he wanted to buy.
Mr. Mollard has been following the story of Mohammed Hatib and the Palestinians' efforts to keep his land.
So he went to court
because
he wanted. He said, "It's part of my land. I'm willing to pay for it again, mm-hmm. but I want the right to buy on it." And now it's in court, and we will wait and see. It
will
be very interesting.
Why wouldn't they let him,
because he's an Arab. He's not Jewish.
Do you think it's fair that it's still in the courts? I mean, shouldn't the Israelis just say, "Fine, this man wants to be with us"?
If you talk fairness, maybe you're right. But we live in a society where there are certain laws, and if I would have been him, I wouldn't even try to go and live within a dense Jewish settlement. It won't fit in. There will be problems.
Ladies and gentlemen, the director of the film, Michael Dutfield, and the crew and I hoped, vainly of course, that that film might help the family stay. It did not. They were all thrown out and went to live in that village of Chizmeh, with the one with the minaret, which the Jewish settlement leader pointed out to us on the film. I find now that my original view of journalism as being a great adventure is probably not true in the Middle East. Page 200 of the book is kind of becoming more and more important to me. I used to think it was a great privilege to watch history. A friend of my father, who like him is also long dead now, once said to me, "Robert, you have seen things that nobody else has seen. Very lucky, fortunate man. Certainly fortunate to be alive. But sometimes I look around me now and I see families, people who can live in comparative peace, who grow up with insurance, with no danger of being thrown out of their homes or killed or shot down or bombed. And I think, did I miss something? And then I wonder, perhaps, if my privilege was not a curse." Thank you for your patience.